crackheads, it's Friday. It can only mean one thing. It is the crack. And my God, look, there are events happening this weekend, but don't know if we're going to talk all that much about them, because we are in the midst of a wild, wild story for the UFC. Crazy, crazy things happening here. Another gambling scandal on the back of the Minner ordeal a few years back. This time, Isaac Dalgarian at the center of it all. I know that Ariel spoke about it from Monday to Wednesday. I know the boys in the back spoke about this yesterday, but the story continues to develop. The Hollywood Reporter have put out some claims about gambling death prescribed to Dana White, which he denies, but they've also told us that Netflix, and you know, you're not going to believe this, Dana White is supposedly the subject of a Netflix documentary focused on his gambling habits. That's according to The Hollywood Reporter. What a time for this to be happening. What a time for the sport. We need to get into it all. And we also have a new unearthed clip from Isaac Dalgarian saying some pretty crazy things about people gifting him things after a UFC loss, which can seem incriminating to even the most skeptical eye. I've got my two main men with me today, and thank God I do, because they're a lot more intelligent and a lot more sophisticated than I am. Please welcome in Chuck Mendenhall and Ben Folks. Lads, thank God you're here. I'm absolutely terrified of this whole ordeal, and I know you are much braver than me. Ben, how are you feeling about this whole situation right now? Because it just keeps coming at me in different ways.
First of all, I want to assure you, everything's going to be fine, BT.
Oh, thank
everything.
God.
I mean, maybe not fine. Maybe some bad stuff is going to happen. Maybe some bad stuff has already happened. But one way or another, it's going to be okay. Eventually, the sun will swallow the earth and all of this will be not that important. That's what I want to say to you here today, first off, right off the top of the bat. Just don't stress out that much about it. Also, you know what? There's an alternate world here where none of this happens and we're sitting here trying to figure out how to make a show out of a fight night with Gabriel Bonfim and a bunch of unranked people on the undercard. This world is probably at least more interesting than that world. So let's be grateful for that.
That's true.
Thank God for the scandals, man. You know what I mean?
How are we feeling over
the scandals start coming and they don't stop coming in this sport.
I'm feeling like you are, Pete. I mean, let's tread lightly on this one, right? Like, we don't have all the facts, but they keep trickling in. And let's face it, we could fashion some tinfoil hats on the show, right? Like, we can do that. We can put those on for an hour.
Absolutely. And there will be speculation will be a theme running out through this because, as has been reported, there's an investigation going on pertaining to Dalgarian's fight with Del Valle last weekend. He was a heavy favorite. The line moved a lot. We have heard from Dana White saying that he was contacted by their own gambling watchdog. And then afterwards, when Del Valle won by rear naked choke, he contacted the FBI himself. Since then, Dalgarian has been cut from the UFC. There has been a lot of reports online, particularly from one Harry Mack, which we'll talk about later on as well, with Factory X refuting some of his claims yesterday, as did Jason Herzog, the referee. Ariel, of course, has been reporting on this throughout the week with multiple people reaching out to him and giving their own stories about people approaching them. Several fighters have tweeted or posted about this on social media too, and then have revoked the statements in some of the cases, which is very interesting in itself. But the lads are doing the show yesterday. And the gambling topic is obviously the thrust of what they're speaking about. And Ben sends us in this Hollywood Reporter article. And I'm like, wow, what could this possibly say? And my God, it had a lot to say.
Look at the Photoshop job they did here on Dana White, too. Because we're clearly what we did.
Dice.
We got the dice and the poker chips. But also clearly what we did is take like one photo where like, you know, maybe he's throwing his arms out as in like the what's up, everybody, welcome to the press conference. But then we took a different face that is like him being like, oh, no. That is clearly what we've added here to create a thing where, and he seems to be falling into what appears to be a gambling vortex. I mean, somebody in the art department over there had some fun with this one.
They're having a good time. Timing is everything on this, Ben. Timing is everything here.
Oh my God. So basically, the the thrust of the claims come from casino.org, as far as the great New York Rick has informed me, and they had an article up about this as well, and they estimated that he'd be between 25 million and 50 in debt to Red Rocks. THR, the Hollywood Reporter, with that fantastic graphic that we just showed you, they believe it's closer to 30 million, and they've zoomed in on that a bit. Dana, though, has come out and completely refuted these claims, as is quoted in THR. This story is pure clickbait bullshit. Everything about this story is completely untrue. But of course, lads, media doesn't care about facts. They care about clicks. This is exactly why I always say you can't believe anything you read.
Anything. So. You cannot believe anything. You pull up to a stop sign. Nope. Don't believe it. Yeah.
Oh, man.
So wait, so this is the comment he gave to them in response when they called him up to be like, hey, we're reporting this story. Do you have anything to say? And instead of going through and talking about what it is, he just says like, hey, everything you are about to write is bullshit. And I know, even though I haven't seen it yet. I mean, surely it can't be all bullshit, right? Like, there must be some fire here beneath all the smoke. If he's just saying like, hey, yeah, I owe some money to some casinos, but I'm good for it. Don't even worry about it. Like, that's one thing. But if you say everything is bullshit, that makes me think that you're not exactly going through with a fine-tooth comb here. You're just trying to make the story die.
In the ebb and flow of gambling, right? Like, if you're gambling in general, like, you generally lose. This is just the house wins. You're generally going to lose. We've seen so much evidence of Dana, like he's proudly shown you how much he loves to gamble over the course of time. I still remember one of the first times I understood it was, I forget where the event was. It might have been in Virginia or something like, or Kentucky. He took a helicopter to Atlantic City. He said he did like a little video vlog thing saying like, hey, we're going to go out and we're going to clean up Atlantic City. We're going to win some money. He comes out like with the, you know, the second part of it. He's got a stack of money, like a couple stacks of money, where he was like, yeah, we went into Atlantic City and we did work, blah, blah, blah. He's been doing this forever. What is, in a weird way, knowing that he gambles six figures on double hands of blackjack and things like that, is it so out of whack that he could lose $20 million? I mean, if you're gambling with such high stakes, you're bound to hit some kind of losing streak at some point. Yeah. And that seems to me modest in a weird way. Like, if you get a stubborn person at a table who's doing six figures, you could rack up millions in a night. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it's just, it doesn't seem so far-fetched to me just based on the evidence that we have.
Well, yeah, and it also seems like, I mean, there's really kind of like two different stories going on here, because it kind of reminds me of the Jordan gambling over golf stories that we used to hear back in the 90s, you know? And I don't think Jordan did a great job handling those at the time, basically because he just didn't want to talk about it, didn't want people looking into what he felt like was his private life. And instead, the way to do it would be like, hey, yeah, I go out on the golf course and gamble. I get a rush and a thrill out of that, but I got the money. Right. So it's not a problem. It's not like, it would be a problem for you if you were losing this kind of money on golf. It would be a problem for us if we were losing, you know, millions of dollars on Baccarat at a Vegas casino. The way to handle it is to be like, look, I'm rich. So
yeah, exactly.
I got the money. I'm good for it. It's not an issue. But when you try to just shut it all down and be like, hey, this is all bullshit. And it's like, well, we have seen you do a lot of gambling. Like you said, Chuck, like my grandfather used to say, they don't build all them casinos in Las Vegas from all the people winning. You know, like you're going to lose sometimes. And so the way to go about it is to kind of just like own up to it, especially because we have seen him doing this stuff. They mentioned in the Hollywood Reporter, they kind of phrase it as if they are suggesting that it's video that sort of leaked out and made the rounds on the internet. But it's from that Roku show that the UFC put out about the UFC, the entire first episode of which is like, hey guys, Dana White is rad. And part of that shows that it was like his birthday. He was on a yacht off the Amalfi Coast.
You know about Amalfi Coast at PT, right?
you know it, PT. You're all up there. You're in the background scrubbing the deck.
Yeah.
It was the night of a UFC event, so they kind of had it on in the corner. You know, we're watching the UFC, but he had somebody come on to the ship to deal them blackjack so that he could play it there. And he made some kind of joke about like, the addiction is real. Like, I kind of, but it's like, you're on vacation. You had some
work though.
Bring
is the guy from a casino? Like, does he have like? He just brings his own private.
Yeah, I think that's
private... how it works.
Okay. And, so crazy. But like, you love it so much, you can't spend a night on the yacht relaxing in the ocean, like all this other stuff that people would love to have. And you got to import the experience that you can get at like Laughlin, Nevada, Harrah's or something. That to me tells you he does really love to gamble, right? And so it's not at all inconceivable that he would have gotten deep in a hole here. And then the story becomes like, A, is that a great idea when you run a fight promotion that's already pretty like tied in with Vegas and gambling and all that other stuff? B, are you racking up debts at your friends' casinos and your friends are covering for you in a way that might be kind of screwing the state of Nevada and like the gambling commission out of their cut of this whole thing? Is there like some kind of like corporate impropriety going on there? And also C, it just happens to be coming out at the worst possible time when people are already looking at the UFC a little bit askance after this Isaac Dolgarian thing.
Yeah. BNC. Yes, circle those.
Like even, lads, the 60-minute thing was only a few weeks ago, and that was gambling as well. Like he wants to present, like he actually presents himself to the world as a gambler. Like, look at me being a fucking badass, throwing hundreds of thousands down.
And like, throwing chips to like, you know, bystander. You know, throwing chips. Here's $50,000. Here's $50,000. He did it to what's the kid over there at Barstool? You know what I'm talking? Robbie Fox.
Oh, Robbie.
Flips
Robbie,
him. Yeah, yeah. Robbie's a great guy. Flips him like a $25,000. Here's for your wedding, man. You know. I mean, it's there's so much footage of him sitting and gambling and having a good time at the tables with huge amounts of money. Sometimes three hands at once. You know.
Yeah.
It goes on.
And like many gamblers, wants to tell us all about it. What he wins.
Yeah,
but not so much when he loses.
Yeah. I guess, though, real quick, is like when you mentioned the B aspect of like just the impropriety of like the state of Nevada and everything that's going on. And you know, Red Rock Casino, right, was the one that they had circled, which obviously is owned by the Fertittas. Who's been, I mean, this is probably where why you want to say get out front of something like that and be like, oh, everything you're reading is bullshit. You know, this is when you're going to want to do it is when there's it's always that kind of I don't know, when guys are associated that deeply with each other that you're like, okay, this story is this isn't common. This isn't a normal whale showing up and losing $20 million. This is a guy who's best friends with the owner.
The Netflix element to this is very strange as well. Like THR, as Ben just said moments ago, like they're filming, as we said, like this is not a secret. You know, they are reportedly filming a documentary about Dana White and his gambling habits while this gambling scandal is going on.
What does documentary mean in this sense? Was my first question when I saw it. Because it's like, especially these days, if there's a documentary about a famous person that's on Netflix, usually that famous person is like an executive producer.
A producer, yeah.
And so we're not seeing a whole lot of like, we're telling the story this person doesn't want told. That doesn't really happen so much, especially with famous people. I mean, it happens like true crime or something, or somebody who is powerless. But with powerful people, that's not usually what we see. And so it makes me wonder, is the Netflix docs another like, you know, Dana White is a rad dude who's out here living a Playboy lifestyle at the blackjack tables until 3 a.m.? Like, is that the story? Because that would seem to be the most likely way they're going with that, right?
It's been done no way 18 like, times as well. The same thing. You know, everyone, like even 60 Minutes were criticized like for the thing they did with that. Like, how could you possibly do a documentary about the UFC gambling, the UFC's president, and not have this scandal in it now? You couldn't possibly do that. You know, this is...
You could tell that the Hollywood Reporter piece was already in bed. Like, it was already with editors when they had to kind of put in parentheses, like, oh, by the way, there's a fighter accused of, like, you know, and was cut by the organization. They kind of had to stuff that in there because I think that would have factored into this a little more had the timing been a little different there.
Yeah, yeah. It's, we should bring up, like, some of the people coming out and refuting claims made by Harry Mack online, who's been all over the story, in fairness, who's been putting out regular updates. Some appear to be refuted. See community notes on X doing its thing over there. Here is a tweet from yesterday. He is BB Harry Mack on X. His tweet says, breaking update, the FBI has raided Factory X, that is Isaac Dolgarian's gym, run by Mark Montoya, who was on Ariel's show earlier this week. It continues, no arrests at this time. Sorry, you just cut out there, but... here is Factory. Sorry, thanks, Rick. No arrests at this time, but they've confiscated phones and conducted interviews. And you'll see the notes there. It says Factory X has denied that this has happened, and we can see the Factory X denial here. Official statement. There is a false report circling that Factory X has been raided by the FBI following the events of last weekend's UFC event. This is not true. The allegations that Adrian had or has any sort of involvement in fight fixing last weekend or ever is both devastating and heartbreaking. It goes on to say that they would be happy to work with the FBI and they are completely clean according to themselves. And we also have Jason Herzog, who Harry Mack, he had said he was under investigation. This is it here. Update, federal regulators have flagged over 100 UFC fights this year for abnormal betting patterns, including two additional fighters on last night's card. Shit is about to get very ugly. I agree. Still working to confirm, but it sounds like the feds are moving to audit Herzog's fights. And I think Herzog has got back to him via DM here, basically telling him to pull back those claims. He is not being investigated as far as the UFC have told him. So there is a lot of mudslinging going on right now. But there, you know, there was a report earlier in the week, right, by Nate Wilcox. I saw his newsletter where he was basically saying that everyone from the officials, referees, fighters, the brass itself, everyone is being investigated. Does it feel like that kind of thing to you, Ben? Does it feel like one of these things where they're doing a complete autopsy on the sport right now?
No, that's not anything that I've heard. And I mean, what I've heard is reactive to some of this stuff where I've heard from people this week who are just like, hey, what's up? They're looking into Herzog. And I'm just like, it seems like that's the only statement I heard that kind of set off that speculation. If I were going to make a list of referees I thought you might want to look into, Jason Herzog wouldn't be on it. I would be surprised to learn that Jason Herzog would be involved in anything. Also, I would be surprised why, if you were going to fix fights, you wouldn't go to the referee. That's not the way you do it in this sport. There are so many things that are out of the referee's hands, unless you're saying Jason Herzog himself is screwing with fight results and has money down on them just like individually and is trying to like lead that charge himself. That would be a very different kind of claim. And also, I just don't even know if that would work very well. Like, I don't think the referee could affect the outcome reliably enough in some of these fights. You know, guy might walk across a cage, get socked in the mouth one time, and he's laid out there. Referee can't really do a whole lot to change that.
Helicopter, it's over. It's over.
Yeah, like if he has money down on that one, he's gonna lose it. You know, like that would not seem to be the way. I mean, the reason this sport and fight sports in general have always been so vulnerable to gambling and corruption is because all you need to do is pay one guy to lose. You don't need to involve the referee. You don't need to involve that guy's opponent. There have been plenty of people in boxing history who had entire careers of fixed fights, and they thought they were great boxers.
Primo.
How dare you? Primo's one example. You know, the guy, honestly, a lot of this, when I was looking at a lot of like how this stuff has played out, both the Derek Minner thing, this Isaac Dolgarian thing, I was really reminded of when I wrote the story on like Jake LaMotta and Sugar Ray, because Jake LaMotta's career mirrors a lot of this, where he fought one of these guys who was a mob controlled fighter who had fought nothing but fixed fights and thought he was really good, and had to throw the fight in order to get the mob to give him a shot at the middleweight title, threw it very poorly in a way that exposed it to everybody. It's the one where that guy who beat him started to go, wait a minute, have all my fights been fake and I'm just now figuring it out? Because LaMotta just did it so badly.
Yeah.
But he also did the same thing that we've seen fighters do, where he went to a doctor before the fight to basically get a diagnosis of a ruptured spleen so that if he was accused, if somebody said, hey, we think that there's something off about this fight, he could say he brought the doctor in to testify for him. And so they did suspend him, much like they suspended Derek Minner. But what they suspended him for was failure to reveal the injury, for concealing the injury ahead of the fight, which, you know, technically on the books you can't do. But in practice, tons of people do all the time in this sport. Kind of wouldn't have a sport if people didn't conceal their injuries ahead of fights. And it's basically the exact same thing. It's, you know, 80 years later, but it's pretty much the exact same thing happening here. The thing to me that makes this really interesting is that now when we live in this age of gambling has its tentacles in all sports, everybody's got a gambling app partner, you're throwing the odds on the broadcast, these apps, though, make it a lot easier to track stuff like this. And so that's what we see here, mm-hmm. right? Is like they have IC360, used to be called US Integrity. They are monitoring this activity on the sports books, and they see something before the fight, and they go to the UFC and say, hey, something weird is happening with the odds on this fight. We're hearing from our sports gambling partners, the sports books we work with. They're saying the action coming in on this is suspicious. The UFC has that information before the fight. That's where I think you need a little bit more robust of a plan of what to do. And you need like a protocol for like what to do. Because according to Dana White, what the UFC did is call up Isaac Dolgarian and his lawyer and basically be like, hey, real quick, though, are you planning to throw this fight? And at that point, you're in a situation where unless the guy says, yeah, I was totally planning to throw the fight, what are you going to do? Like, you need him to either like go, oh, shit, they're on to me. And then you risk pissing off some people who already paid you money and laid their bets down. Or you need him to say, yeah, I was planning on throwing the fight. Because instead he's like, no, I'm not going to throw the fight. And they go, okay, good enough. Let's go. Like, that's where you need to have a better plan in place if you're the UFC.
You know what? Just like in the LaMotta sense you were talking about, when something like this thing happens with Dolgarian, you start reflecting. You know what I mean? Like, all of a sudden you're thinking back on other things. And this is just the natural, like you said, you start to doubt what you've seen, or like you start to question certain things that you've seen. And if you, to be honest, you remember the fight, like, so when he was fighting Christian Rodriguez, which was another loss of his.
Split decision.
It was a split decision. But if you looked at the way that fight played out, it was a 10-8. He went out there and he destroys the guy the first round, 10-8. Then the fight turns a 10-8 the other way. In the third round, these things then become suspicious, don't they? Like, if you get a guy who, you know, brings a red flag into the cage with him, suddenly a lot of his career starts to do this. But that it's just, I think that's where, if nothing else comes of it, there's going to be a moment right now, I think, where everything's going to look suspicious and everything will be enhanced and maybe more scrutinized than ever before on this front.
You're right. And, you know, your column on it this week, Chuck, I thought really hit that nail on the head there. Because if we're all talking gambling stuff, there's odds all over the broadcast, all this stuff. As soon as people start to get that in their heads, especially if they personally have money now where they're like, I needed this parlay to hit and it didn't. And now I'm looking around and being like, well, I have reason to think some of this stuff has been messed with in the past. Did I just get screwed here? Once that paranoia sets in, I think it's hard to get out.
Paranoia is the right word, too. I really think that's kind of what starts to happen is a paranoia takes over.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned Dolgarian, who we will be mentioning throughout this situation. Obviously, in the immediate aftermath of the fight last weekend, a clip surfaced of him speaking about he believes that the fighter should get a percentage of the winnings of these bets. Which people saw as a bit of a red flag that a guy's having these conversations in the lead up to a fight. Another clip has surfaced in the last couple of days. It's an interview with Jonhyun Ko, and I believe it's in the aftermath of this split decision loss to Christian Rodriguez. And very, very, you know, if you're looking for red flags, here are some red flags. He says that Steve Will Do It, one of the Nelk boys, a friend of Dana White, a man who's on camera gifting Dana White $500,000, gifting Dana White a luxury car worth $300,000. He says that he bought him a house after this fight. He also says that the country and western singer Zach Bryan helped me because he didn't think I lost that fight. We're going to roll the clip here because it's truly bizarre.
My life got a lot better because I lost that fight. Some things took place in my life that, you know, probably wouldn't have happened if I would have won. I'm super grateful. I've been living my best life since that last fight, and, you know, I'm hoping to get back on the right track.
Well, what are these things? Can you reveal to us what happened?
Well, I got this beautiful house.
Of course.
My sponsors, people do it, help me out a lot on that, you know. I just have I'm getting all the recovery and stuff that I should have been getting before that I couldn't necessarily afford. So, yeah, man, I'm just happier. I have my daughter now with me, and everything's just looking up since that fight. I actually had Zach Bryan. He messaged me after my fight. Cool, he's an awesome country singer, and he helped me out with some. he helped me out a little bit for losing that fight because he thought I won as well. So that was amazing to get that.
Well, holy shit, boys. things actually probably went well for me that wouldn't have went well had I not, had I won that fight, is a line that's absolutely insane. We also have an embrace between Dulgarian and the Nelk boys, and New York Rick has informed me that this is a Nelk boys fight night that they ran in kind of with Dana White there, obviously, where they were going to see if, you know, this guy's going to be sponsored by Happy Dad or something to that effect. It was a fight night they ran, but there we go, all very cozy. this is pretty fucking crazy, right, Chuck? Like, I'm doubting myself seeing these things. Like, am I making a mountain out of a molehill here?
You want to be responsible in like how you approach these types of things, right? Because you don't want to start making accusations. But it is a very, how many prelim fighters, right? Dulgarian stature, like. Go on. Like, I mean, these guys, if they lose dude wipes for 10 grand off their trunks, they're very upset. But you've got a guy who's saying, like, hey, somebody bought me a house. You know, this is a prelim fight. This is not a highly visible man. Why is he this connected? You know, I think that that's really the thing. Why is he this connected? Like, generally speaking, we've talked to many, many fighters. How many of them are in this situation? How many times have you been? Ben, you've been talking to guys a long time. Like, have you seen people come in? I mean, I know that there are always sponsors who are going to come in. You hear about that all the time, but there's no red flags around it. I just, it's one of those things where you're like, if a guy is talking about a house that he received or collecting money for, oh, you should have won that fight here. That's a little weird. That's a little red flaggish. And I got to say, man, I mean, and again, I want to talk responsibly here. I'm not making accusations, but there is a tie between Zach Bryan and, you know, like going back into the MMA world. I was hanging out at a concert of his that I went to do a piece on Diego Lopez with some Iridium fighters who were like, so it was Diego and some other guys, and Jason House was there. There's a connection. I mean, these guys all know each other, and, you know, I don't know how deep things go between these guys, but you know, one of the big chief parts of this involvement was that a guy like Zach Bryan pays attention to every fight on a card from the prelims on. And this was a thing where I was like, wow, man, I mean, he must really be a fan. Now, this could be that he is just a big fan. You know what I mean? Like that he's a huge fan. And he thought that a guy, his buddy, Jason House's guy, went down and was like, that's unfair. You should get something. Who knows? But I'm saying this is what it does. It makes you start reflecting, right? It starts making you look all over the place for things that seem suspicious. I feel like that's kind of where we're going in the fight game at this moment.
Absolutely, man. Like that's crazy. It's there is just so many red flags. I don't know how, given what's being alleged here, you cannot look at a clip like that and be like, well, that's just out of the goodness of everyone's heart here. Like, you'd be crazy to just be like, well, what a great guy, you know, buying this lad a house for losing on the prelims, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
And, I mean, it's weird because once you start to talk about it, you feel like you're, you know, rust coal in the storage unit connected and everything with, like,
I know,
red string, and you're seeing connections everywhere. And, like, you don't want to, like, fall down that rabbit hole if it's not merited. But it also, it does seem strange, and it seems strange that people seem to be circling the wagons a little bit on this. Like, unless I've missed it, have we heard anything from Isaac Dulgarian on this situation? Like,
not that I've seen.
I was keeping an eye on his social medias because he was posting leading up to the fight, you know, right up to fight night. He's posting stuff on Instagram and Twitter. And I would think, if you were accused of something like this, which is very, very potentially a career-ending accusation if you don't manage to strongly refute it, I would want to get out there right away and be like, oh, no, no, I didn't do anything. I had a bad night. It can happen to anybody, but there is no malfeasance here, because this is blackball territory that you're in. Mm-hmm. And people found that 100%. You took money and you threw a fight. You know, you're going to get shoeless Joe Jackson right out of this sport. with that on the line, you would think you would offer a pretty strong defense for yourself if there was absolutely nothing to it. And to say nothing at all and just kind of let this narrative run away where people are absolutely burying you out there, that seems like almost an admission. You know, I'm surprised that it has gone on this long without kind of any statement. You're not going to be able to lay low on it forever, right?
No. Do you, Dana obviously came out and he refuted the hundreds of fights thing. And honestly, like, I can kind of see it from that point of view. Like, we're all kind of, we're talking about this and, you know, we usually, when something goes glaring in a fight, we usually all cop it. We're always just like, what is happening here? Like, we saw DC, we saw Chiesa immediately being like, this is weird. Like, this does not look like a fight. So I can see to Dana's point of view to some degree. Like, he's like, I'm at these fights all the time. Like, at this situation like this, the Minner situation, this situation, it doesn't happen a lot. I know, Ben, you had a great piece out about the deja vu element to this because of the Minner situation. Where do you sit on that? Like, is it believable to you that hundreds of fights would be investigated after a situation like this?
Hundreds of fights seems... strange. That seems like way more than I would expect. But I also feel naive if I sit here and go, the UFC and the regulators have a 100% success rate of catching this. It's happened twice, the Minner situation and now, and they got them both times.
Yeah.
Like, that feels a little too just like unrealistic for how these things usually go. I mean, it should be easy to catch people doing this just because of all the data you have if they're placing so many of these bets through online sports books. And what you hear from people, I remember working on a story about the Minner situation back when it happened, and I was also working kind of for a website in the sports gambling world. And so I had a little bit more of those contacts. I talked to the guy who's the president of US Integrity at the time. He was saying, we've known for a while that the UFC has a problem of fighters and coaches and people in that world betting on their own fights or on fights that they know somebody that they're involved in, and that it happens there way more than it happens in other sports like the NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball. And we've told the UFC that we think that this is a problem and that they need to do more about it, and that they've been kind of slow to react to that. And if you go back and you look, this used to be a pretty common storyline going into fights where it'd be like, so-and-so is betting his purse on himself. Yep. So-and-so is big betting time on his brother who, you know, the Pettis is betting on each other. This guy's betting on his training partners. And I can understand how they didn't see it as anything going wrong, because you're betting on yourself. You're betting,
right?
You know, because you're saying, I know this guy. I trained with this guy. He's going to kill this dude. I'm going to cash in on it. I remember being.
Well, that's why the Krause thing, though, like, right, was so weird because he's betting. Yeah. He's kind of giving advice to go against the guy within his camp.
Yeah. I remember Renzo Gracie being at this IFL event the night Matt Serra beat GSP, and he was like, I had $10,000 down on Matt Serra because he's my friend and everything. And he was very excited about both the victory for Matt Serra and also the financial windfall for himself. But it's like, that's been a normal part of like the discussion for many years. And so you can see that it just got in there where people got used to it. Even before the days of sports gambling apps, we're just in Vegas a lot of the time. You got to walk past the sports book to get into the MGM Grand Garden Arena. You know, like, it's right there. And so that connection was already there, and maybe we should have been a little bit more worried about it at the time. But it's like, for them to say, hey, we've been telling the UFC you need to do more to stop these fighters, they don't seem to see it as something wrong. It makes it a little easier for them to be like, well, I know my friend is hurt and he's going into this fight basically to get the insurance to pay for his knee surgery at the end of it. I don't think he's going to win. I don't even think he thinks he's going to win. Let me go ahead and profit off it. And then at that point, that's how you do get into like a gambling controversy.
Yeah. Chuck, you know, we spoke about your article earlier. The headline refers to the situation as an ultimate nightmare. We've also had the Krause Minner situation, and we were speaking before we went live here today, and we're kind of saying, like, we didn't get the closure. Like, people say it hasn't gone away, but it's out of sight, out of mind. Do you feel like there will be some closure from this situation? Because it actually feels like there needs to be, given what's at stake here, the legitimacy of the sport.
Well, it's like this is the third time, right? What was the other one? There was another one, like it was overseas. There was a fight.
Tae-Hon Bang and Leo Kuntz, that one.
Right. Oh, shit, Bang, yeah. The Bang Kuntz.
Well, there, that somebody fight, did go to prison. You know, like that. There in, yes, South Korea, they actually did prosecute it. And that was kind of before the gambling episode. I think it was like 2017, right?
So, but the Minner one, when it happened, it was like we were kind of going back to that one. Now you're kind of going from that, the Minner one, we're kind of referencing that more readily than the first one. And that's kind of why I feel like this is, okay, now you've got somewhat of a trend established, even if it's isolated in like instances that we know of. I think that, you know, there's been a few times, and I kind of always catch myself, if you're writing something, you're like, you know, we've never really had, and I pointed this out a million times, because boxing for 40 years, 50 years, had a mob run, you know, the mob was involved in boxing so deeply that, you know, it threw the integrity of the sport out the window in a lot of ways through big pockets of time. And I was like, you know, we really haven't, it's kind of crazy that we haven't had that in the sport, not necessarily through mob, you know, it could be through anything, right? Because it's a prize fighting event. As that's what I was thinking about in this piece. You're like, it's prize fighting. And if you can make way bigger prizes, you know, by just playing the game a certain way, you might be tempted, especially if you don't really feel like you're going anywhere. The rational side of my brain says that there should be a lot of people susceptible to this. I tried to point out, like, the susceptible is kind of the word, right? Because these are not athletes who are making millions of dollars. A lot of these people, as Ben, you know, like we've talked about this a million times, are not even making, you know, once they pay their corners and everything, they're probably not even making six figures. These are guys who are veterans within the UFC in a year. And I mean, that's so different from a pro athlete. And we're seeing the controversy in other sports. It's not like you're not seeing it elsewhere too, with guys who do make millions of dollars. But for guys who don't make millions of dollars, or even like hundreds of thousands of dollars, there's a huge temptation there.
Have we heard from fighters who basically tell us, I went in debt for this training camp to get to this fight?
A million,
you know,
times.
And so you can see, like, there are a number of things that make MMA more vulnerable and fight sports in general more vulnerable. And that's one of them, the low pay. Like you said, in the NBA betting scandal, that tells you that just having huge money involved isn't necessarily going to keep people from getting greedy and stupid and doing something. But it would probably help. It probably helps some of them, like walk some of them off the ledge. And in addition to that, you have just the nature of this sport is that the UFC doesn't really see these guys for the most part until they show up on fight week. They're off doing their own thing, doing their own training. The UFC doesn't really hear from them. It's, hey, are you going to take this fight? Yes or no? Okay, this is the date. You know, we send the drug testers to you every once in a while. But we don't have that kind of daily oversight that you have of NFL players, NBA players. You know, they disappear into all corners of the world, and then they show up on fight week when it's time to fight. And I also think that the UFC really, it has to do more, and it should want to do more, because the process that Dana White outlined for us, where he was like, hey, we got a call from the company that we work with, whose job is to do this for us, is to monitor activity on these sports books and tell us when something looks off. They told us that part of the system worked. You got an early warning before the fight happened, and your response is just to call up the guy and ask him if he's fixing the fight. And so there's not really many realistic ways that your own system can work for you at that point, if that's all you're going to do, because there's several good reasons why he's not going to be like, yes, I'm fixing the fight. And from Dana White's telling, the only thing he could have said that would lead to them not going forward with this fight was if he had said, yeah, I'm fixing it. I'm going to load in there and lay down. And obviously, for a lot of reasons, he's not going to do that. And so then you just say, like, all right, go ahead with the fight. Which at that point, you're kind of doing a disservice to your fans, to the other people who have bet on this thing, thinking that it's on the up and up. You should be a better steward for the sport at that point if you're the UFC, if only to avoid weeks like this, where the entire week we spend talking about if and how many of your fights might be fixed. You don't want that. You definitely don't want it when the Hollywood Reporter is out here talking about Dana White's in a huge gambling debt. You don't want to deal with that at all. And the UFC's reaction so many times in this has just been like, no, nothing to see here. Go away. Not a story. That was the first reaction with the Minner thing.
This is complete bullshit.
Yeah.
This is complete bullshit.
If you remember, Dana White's reaction right after that Derek Minner thing happened was, I don't think there's anything wrong here. He said, quote, zero evidence that anybody involved in this fight did anything. And then the evidence pretty quickly came forward. And so it was just like a few weeks, a month later, he was like, they're going to go to federal fucking prison. This is serious. And they're in big, big trouble. That was 3 years ago. No one has gone to federal fucking prison over that. There were athletic commission suspensions. The stiffest penalty was Jeff Molina, the teammate who bet on it, got a 3-year suspension from the Nevada State Athletic Commission. You need something to happen to show, and you should want something to happen. You should want to be seen as like, we are proactive and we are aggressive about stopping this. You should have wanted to pull this fight from the card. Because if you pull that fight from the card and it ends up being all smoke and no fire, it's not going to derail the UFC's plans to not have this Isaac Dolgarian fight on the undercard of one of the least memorable UFC fight night event lineups that you had. You could have done that. And instead, you're just like, you wanted to believe everything is fine. You want everything to be okay. And so you're not taking the threat seriously enough that it might not be okay. And it's way worse for you now to be dealing with this fallout when you could have got out in front of it and you could have been seen as like, hey, we are part of the solution to this and not just like, you know, vaguely indifferent to it.
Well said. Well said. Well, we have a few more things to talk about, lads, but let's hit up our first break of the day. We'll be back in 2 minutes to discuss Francis Ngannou, Jake Paul, apparently, and how that could affect the slim chances of him returning to the UFC in the future. We'll be back in 2. And we are back on the crack, ladies and gentlemen. We discussed all of the gambling scandal up until this point. 7 things have probably happened while we were discussing that for 40 minutes, the way this story's going. Another story from this week has been the fallout from Tank Davis. Obviously, we spoke about this last week, and I think we all predicted this would be a great time to just completely withdraw from this situation, given the severity of the situation with Davis, and of course, a repeat offender. He has pulled out of that fight. They're now looking for a replacement for December. We have seen Nate Diaz saying that, well, he just took to Twitter and accepted the fight. I don't know if it's that easy.
Is that how it works? Do you do that?
Oscar De La Hoya has eliminated the rumors that Ryan Garcia would fight Jake Paul. But another person who has had plenty of back and forth with Jake Paul is the lineal heavyweight champion of the world. And we're still going with that, right? Francis Ngannou.
I think so.
Still and, true.
Yeah, I mean, good point. But I got to say, this is, as much as we give these fights shit, like, that is a way better fight. Like, immediately, as far as I'm concerned.
Sure.
Even though I've had my pants pulled down every time with these Jake Paul fights, I think this is a way better fight than the Tank Davis one. Chuck, would you agree with that?
100%. But the times when we kind of get Jake paired up with somebody where you're like, okay, now this I'll watch, it doesn't really happen. So, I mean, I feel like this is like the type of blue ball flirtation that we've seen in the past. The only thing I will say is that I think Francis is, it's hard to get Francis's attention at this point, but I do think something like this would. You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of, if he didn't look at it as kind of like, well, this is probably the easiest thing I could do directly in front of me and make a lot of money. I don't know. Like, it just seems like this would be, the guy just got through fighting, you know, Tyson Fury and Anthony Joshua before the, like, going back to MMA. This feels to me like it would be like, okay, now I'm going against a guy who doesn't have nearly the chops or the experience as those guys. And I was able to hang with Fury, you know, through that fight. So I think that it would appeal to him. And of course it would appeal to a public that on some level is like, why don't you fight somebody your own size and age, you know, to Jake Paul? And I feel like this is probably the closest you would get. In fact, he would have to be the prohibitive underdog, I would think, in something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, I don't think Jake Paul would ever fight Francis Ngannou. I don't think Jake Paul's that dumb. I think Francis Ngannou would do a terrible, terrible thing to him, and we would all be accomplices if we watched it.
Terrible and, from whose point of view?
Well, see, we would feel bad afterwards. It might feel good in the moment, might feel good leading up to it. It'll feel bad in the morning. I don't think Jake Paul is serious about any of this.
No.
I think that he's just doing the thing that he does where he's great at getting attention. But the thing that has made his boxing career the success such as it is he's really good at target selection. He's really good at picking somebody where we go, I don't think you should, but maybe I guess you could. And he's kind of ridden that all the way to the bank. And I understand why Francis Ngannou, it kind of seems from the tone of these tweets. Do you remember when he was in the ring with Tyson Fury, who made a remark suggesting that he thought Francis Ngannou, as he put it, had a big Corey?
That's right.
And yes. and Francis Ngannou made a face like, that's crass and I wish you wouldn't do that. You know? Like,
you, sir.
And yeah, that and that yeah. feels that feels like the tone of these tweets, kind of, where not so much like, no, I'm not going to fight you, I'm scared to fight you or anything, but more like, don't drag me into this thing that you do. I, you know, because you could spot that it's Jake Paul doing that thing. He lost one opponent. He's got to generate some other headlines. He's trying to just like spin it off into something else. That's a natural instinct for him. And Francis Ngannou is kind of being like, I don't want to play. I see the game that you're doing, and I don't want to be involved in that. So leave me alone. Leave me out of it. And I also understand why Francis Ngannou is like, hey, look, you're not going to be like, hey, I was trying to fight Gervonta Davis, who I towered over and had like a 100-pound weight advantage over. That didn't work out. So real quick, can I fight you? And you're just being like, that's a little insulting, honestly. You know, I'm not your backup plan. I'm not like your Friday night plans fell through. You're going to call me up and you're going to hit me with a you up text. Like, I don't want to do that. I understand why Francis Ngannou would take it that way. And I don't, I think it's all just headline generation. By
and also just posturing, you know, because I don't really think Jake, but like you mentioned, it's just more like, hey, look, it's on the record. I was willing to fight Ngannou. You saw
the
that,
old
right? I was trying to fight him. Yes, exactly. Yeah. I wanted that fight, but it didn't happen, you know, because Francis didn't want it or something like that. It's all posturing because I'm with you, Ben. I don't think that Jake Paul, if he wants to continue on what he's doing, this would not be a smart move by him to take on Ngannou.
It is like,
if he wants to keep his head on his shoulders, it would be a good idea to take on Ngannou.
That's true, but like, the PFL don't have a compelling option for Francis. Maybe for us, right? We'd watch an MCOT fight. We'd be very happy to watch a fight like that. They just don't have.
Can I ask you guys something? Remember the $2 million like negotiation for any opponent who's going to step up and fight? Whatever happened to this? Surely they can find somebody.
They signed everyone to contract extensions with the UFC. Remember the Derek Lewis situation?
Look at who we got in the UFC's heavyweight division right now. Do you think that that's as a result of them letting a lot of guys walk into free agency who are heavyweights? I mean, anybody who is above 230 pounds and knows how to put their hands next to their face is signed to a heavyweight deal somewhere in MMA. We are hurting for quality heavyweights. So, it's not like there's a whole bunch of out-of-work MMA heavyweights. I remember, do you remember Frank Mir once saying a thing where he was showing his wife, I think, like a Bellator heavyweight fight, and he was just basically being like, look how bad they are. And she went, oh my God, you could fight until you're 50 if you want. She was horrified. She was horrified by the prospect, and he was like, I know.
Like, I know.
Get
that's
ready.
The state of the heavyweight division.
Little dollar signs in his eyes.
Oh, man, it is to be said, though, like, if you're Jake Paul, the one thing that this could really do is not just generate eyeballs, not just generate, like, you know, the kind of fight that Netflix might be looking for, it would really piss off Dana White. It would. I mean, that is the one thing where you're like, do you know what would really piss Dana White off? A massive Netflix marquee of Jake Paul be the guy who never lost the UFC heavyweight title, which they would say all the way through the promotion. Mm-hmm. On the flip side of that, we are hoping, we are praying that there's somehow Francis Ngannou could be reintroduced to the UFC heavyweight situation with Tom Aspinall, etc. This was very much a conversation before the eye poke incident with Gan, but I think if he was to do this, as much as it would help Jake Paul piss Dana White off, I think it would be the death of any return. As slim as them hopes are, Chuck, like, that would be no way that could happen at that, if he does fight Jake Paul, right?
I mean, even given the circumstances right now, I don't get the indication that the businessman in Dana's head, like, prevails over, like, the grudge he holds over, like, Francis Ngannou. For whatever reason, man. And I mean, he points it out all the time. In fact, he's one of those guys who's like, I wish I could just, like, change the people's perception about his person in general, like his whole personality. Like, he's not the guy you think he is. This dude is, he's not, you know, he tries to kind of almost, you know, throw, like, you know, to kind of stain his reputation. That's where it's at. Like, he doesn't want people liking Francis Ngannou, much less want to do business with him. I don't know if he's thought on any of that. I feel like the kind of public pressures that we've talked about, hey, man, you might want to bring in this guy, lineal champion, all this, especially with John Jones not playing ball, maybe wearing the scent. And I don't know if that's gotten anywhere through this whole process. It just doesn't feel like Dana is affected like he used to be in this. Because I think sometimes back in the day, you know, you go back to guys like Randy Couture and you know, people that he's, Tito, guys he had feuds with, he would get over them if the business was right in the end. Like he would put it aside. I've gotten no indication so far. There's not even been one moment where you're like, well, maybe he's thawing a little bit on the Ngannou thing. But so far, I just haven't seen that.
I don't know. I could see it happening if it was something that looked like it would be a big enough deal. I also think that if it were something that looked like it would be a big enough, profitable enough deal, that it might not be left up to Dana White entirely to make that decision. I think that the guys at TKO would be, hey, we have what they call a fiduciary responsibility to the shareholders and whatnot. And if you can make a ton of money having Francis Ngannou come back and fight, then you make a ton of money. And that's it. I mean, I think maybe the bigger obstacle would Francis Ngannou say yes. He doesn't need the money at this point. He left there with a real bitter taste in his mouth. So I can understand if he was just like, no, not interested in working with those guys again. The ones I kind of feel weirdly bad for in all this is the PFL. Because you went, you signed Francis, you tried to make a big move when you saw the opportunity to make one, the kind of thing we've all been saying you should do. You met all his terms, all this stuff. And it just really hasn't worked out at all. You got one fight out of him. You got these events in Africa that Francis didn't even go to. You got a little bit of a beef with your own guy at that sense where, you know, you're arguing back and forth about who didn't live up to their obligations there. And regardless of what they say about their odds of getting him back in the PFL cage in 2026, I'd be shocked at this point if Francis Ngannou ever fights for them again.
I would too. Yeah. I think another it's a real outside shot, but like if Francis's contract is coming up next year, and Eddie Hearn makes a splurge into the MMA world, like that's who he's going after. Yeah. Like that I 100% think he'd be the guy you go after. Because he's obviously a fucking huge deal. If he's a free agent, he's a free agent.
And there's, you could see that happening because Francis might be like, hey, man, you know, Eddie, I know what you're doing. And, you know, I think there's a little bit of him that's like, yeah, I could get at Dana and I could, you know, answer some things the other way. You're absolutely right, Ben. That's a good shout in terms of like, you get the sense that that Francis is a principled person. And honestly, like the kinds of stipulations he was coming up with when he was negotiating his deal, that the UFC was like, no, man, we don't do this sort of thing. We don't negotiate all the things you're trying to do here. We're not going to do that. He seemed to stand by, you know, as it was going on. So there, if anything, he may be the one in the end that would probably be the likelier scenario is if the UFC was like, hey, man, would you want to do this? That Francis would be the one who would be like, no, not for me.
Yeah.
He made a lot of money too. You know what I mean? Dana always points this out. When guys make a lot of money, it's difficult to get them in the ring again. This is a guy who made a lot of money outside of the UFC.
Yeah. I think he said that recently about Max Holloway, whose all of his total performance of the night bonuses came to 1 million or something. He's like, a lot of money. And I was like, yeah, really? This guy, you know?
Bad night gambling, you know? Just a lot of money.
Night down the Bellagio. I wanted to ask you guys about this because there was obviously all this talk about heavyweight and how stale it was and the fact that we had John v. Cyril, and we talked about it a bit last week, the rematch now having so much more intrigue. Waldo Cortez Acosta has this massive wild performance against D'Elia, who looks like he won. We slow it down. There was a whole situation there, how different it was to Asmal's. I wrote about it earlier this week in terms of how it was officiated. But he comes out of it like a bona fide contender. And he has a narrative now with Tom Asmal, like, this is how you react to getting your eyes gouged out, my friend. It's a weird one. But are things beginning to become more interesting again, Ben? Like, with all this wild shit that's happened, is it a bit, like, I think it's a good bit more interesting than it was on the way into UFC 321. For all the wrong reasons, of course.
Yeah, it's a certain kind of interesting, right? Especially because the leading up, to the main event of 3-2-1, right? You had on the undercard that fight between Alexander Volkov and Jailton Almeida, where you came out of it, yeah, saying wolf. In the wake of the Isaac Dolgarian stuff, somebody put forth the theory. They're like, what if when we see these bad heavyweight fights, what we're really seeing is somebody screwed up and different people accidentally paid both guys to lose? And
I've seen fights that certainly appear that way.
Yeah, it's going to be my new theory going forward. When we see a terrible fight, is just to be like, the wires got crossed. Each of these guys is trying not to win. And so
both of these lads want houses. Yeah.
What did Zach Bryan do here? You know, you're just like, you're heading into the main event being like, man, geez, what are we going to do after this one? And then because of how weird the main event gets, you go, I guess we're just going to turn around and do this one again, which is good because we didn't have a better idea. And then to have this happen the next weekend where it's like Big Tom's friend and training partner goes out there and gets himself into an even weirder situation. Like this one, I still think the way this one played out, and I know that there might be a challenge to the results here. We'll see where that goes. But as I was watching the fight, you're listening to the commentary tell you, well, here's what's got to happen now. This is it. And then 2 minutes later, something completely different that they said could not happen happens. And we restart the fight. And as somebody wrote into the co-main event this week and made this point where they were like, hey, you know, when they restarted that fight, it was just weird just to take one guy's on the stool drinking water, the other guy's celebrating with his team, and to tell him like, nope, everybody get out of here. We're going again. And like, that's strange. That's a strange way to do this. And they were like, you know, when they restart the fight, you can hear Brendan Fitzgerald say, you know, you got to love this sport. You just never know. And they were like, no, you guys seem to never know. You guys are the ones on the commentary telling us what the rules say, what has to happen. And you don't seem to know, you know, because weird stuff is always happening. And you come out of that one and you're just like, I mean, I guess like that's a good win for Waldo Cortez Acosta. Is it though? Because it's like, does that win stand up? You know, you went and you knocked the guy out like weirdly right after the restart for this whole thing. It's a strange way to try to build a narrative and build your way. I mean, it's been built on frailer ground than that, especially in the UFC heavyweight division. But it's the whole thing is just weird, man. Really weird.
Yeah.
Weird, but exciting, Chuck.
Yeah. Yeah, exciting is a good word for that. Are you guys digging the John Jones sort of, I feel like, is this what you're going to talk about?
We have a clip. I think we should play the John Jones.
Okay, all right,
If we can, New York, Rick, just because.
Talk to me about what you saw in his fight with Gane. I mean, because Gane looked like he was controlling the fight.
With Cyril Gane?
Yeah.
I feel as Tom. Tom's a great athlete. But I do feel like he's a one-trick pony. I believe that his wrestling and jiu-jitsu is incredibly overrated. He has a beautiful 1-2. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I got to learn a lot about his patterns in his last fight. Beautiful 1-2. That's really about it. That's the one thing that he's setting up real nice. He couldn't touch Cyril Gane at all. That's the way I felt. I felt like Gane was just getting warmed up. Gane's hands was down. He's shaking his shoulders, bouncing around.
He was touching him. He was touching him.
That jab too was money.
He busted him open.
He was so comfortable.
I think Tom was looking for a way out, and he took it. He needs to change his game plan.
Man, when Tom gets hurt, it's like he's like immediately incapacitated. Mm-hmm. Immediately.
He shut down.
It's like you poke my eye, and then he's like immediately. There's no like.
He never tried to look. It was rag on the eye immediately.
Dude, I've been the silliest looking cat on national TV. Just
trying. He didn't try.
Trying.
He didn't try.
Same thing with Curtis Blaze. When he hurt his knee, there was no limping. There was no trying to get up. It was just like immediately.
Yep.
Oh, burn my village. I can't go on.
Like, he doesn't have the dog in him. Yeah, that killer be killed.
Immediately quits.
Yeah.
When he got tapped out with an ankle lock, there was no trying to fight his hands. There were no trying to. He immediately quit.
You see the pattern of
immediately.
It.
Immediately.
Yeah.
You think what Jones just came for the saloon there? It's like.
Yeah, where did he find that black cowboy hat that he's been wearing around all over the place? Was he like on vacation in Santa Fe and he walked into a store and he saw it and he was just like, everything's about to change. Like, because he seems to have got that hat and he's not taking it off. Like, he's you know, we're wearing that hat to the gym. You know, we're wearing it.
Dirty boxing.
Yeah.
Do you reckon a few quid changed hands for that interview, lads? Any chance there was a paid appearance there, would you say?
There's an irony, isn't there, of John Jones being like, Tom quits as soon as it gets tough, when, bro, we just watched you quit the entire sport rather than fight Tom Aspinall for millions and millions of dollars of Saudi money. You know, like that it's an interesting thing to say about the guy. Also, because it's like, people have been trying to paint this picture in the wake of the Tom Aspinall fight as if like he was getting beat up by Ciryl Gane and that's why he looked for an opportunity to get out of there. And he wasn't really. I mean, he got bloodied up. It went better for Ciryl Gane than we expected. He looked he was on the way to winning that first round, but it wasn't a blowout.
Right.
It wasn't like Tom was getting his ass beat. It was just, he just didn't come out there and dominate it the way we're used to seeing him dominate. And so there was nothing in his body language or his approach at all to me in that fight that looked like he was like, I got to get out of here. This is going terribly. You know, what happened was he got two fingers shoved into his eyeballs until you could see the tip of the finger disappear into his eye. And so to especially for John Jones, the other irony is that John Jones is one of the most prolific eye pokers we have seen in the UFC. There's an old video interview of John Jones being 100%. Like, I poke people in the eye. Like, it's a good strategy. Here's why it works. And, you could see him doing it. And so for him to be like, I would have been trying to pry my eyeball open. It's like, no, the other guy would have been trying to pry his eyeball open.
The first thing you hear, like, if you talk to Dominic Reyes or if you talk to Glover Teixeira, like, just ask them. First thing about Jones, and that's the first thing they mention, is like, you got to get through those pokes in the eye, man, because he's coming at you with his hands like this. I mean, it's so like, it's so like John Jones to do that, to make that. But I am optimistic, man, because it feels to me like he's trying to talk himself into this, which is not where he was a couple months ago, right? Like, if you're starting to now say like, he's a one-trick pony, he can't really do this, I think he's overrated here and there. You're now building some kind of thing in your head where you're saying, I could beat him, which is, I don't think we were there not too long ago. I don't think that we were having that discussion.
Don't you think like this would be difficult for Tom to deal with? Like, it's not as much the physical adversity, like the eyes, which, we haven't got an update on yet. And it wasn't very positive when we did hear from Andy last week. But like, just in terms of all this scrutiny from his peers, like, I don't think it's much media. It's more like fighters, the online guys who lost a leg of their parlay over this, seeing it all. Like, Chuck, do you think like that's like what we'll be zooming on here on the next one? Like, this perception of Tom Aspinall that he now has to deal with in the lead up to a rematch.
Well, they've made it a narrative, right? Like, people have made this a narrative. So if it becomes a narrative, that's fine. I think that like a lot of times this does happen. If you start to get evidence or people just keep saying something like this, it becomes part of the fact, even if it's not. I certainly don't believe that, and I think that all of the, I think that the evidence we've had with Aspinall is that he's made of tougher stuff than that. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like you would all of a sudden be like, oh, you trained all this time. You waited 15 months just to go in there, face a little adversity, gets a little bit of a nosebleed. And he's like, I'm done. I want a way out of this. That doesn't make sense to me. So if that is a running narrative, if it go into a rematch, I think it's the wrong narrative. And I think that like, in the end, he'll show that, but it's the fight game, man. I mean, people are going to do this kind of thing. Like, John Jones is going to have his field day. The guys who, the fellow fighters, all that stuff, they're going to have their field day with this type of thing.
Absolutely. We're going to have one more break and then we'll be back to talk to you about a lovely feature that Mr. Ben Folks has coming out over the weekend. And we will also answer your super chats, which I never forget. So I'll see you in 2 minutes. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. What a fantastic show it has been already. And, I got corrected immediately on my exit there because the article that I was going to tickle your balls about immediately now.
Wow.
It's already up. So let the tickling of the balls stop. Take it away, Mr. God Ben Folks.
This reminds me.
That's a table setter.
Earlier when we were talking about the Jake Paul stuff, you made the comment, I've had my pants pulled down by every one of these Jake Paul fights. Chuck, I'm sure you noticed this too.
I did.
At this point, I always have to wonder, is this an Irish saying or is this a Pizzi saying? Because I've been wrong before trying to guess.
You're left pantsed on the street going like, oh, I'm going to stay up for this great fight. And everyone's just like, ah, oh, he's got his ass out again. This fight wasn't great. You know what I mean? Like, that's what I mean.
I gotcha.
Is that an experience that happens? Where maybe you're out there on the street, somebody runs up and pantses you as an adult? Like, we're not talking middle school here. We're talking...
I just stand in the middle of Blanchardstown Village being like, hear ye, Jake Paul is in another blockbuster fight on Netflix.
This is why they keep graffitiing your house, man. Because of stuff like
the rat.
As for all the feature that I'm supposed to tickle your balls about, I spent some time with Frank Shamrock talking about, you know, where he's at. And of course, the big question with Frank Shamrock is that he is the glaring omission from the UFC Hall of Fame. And you look at some of the other guys from that era who are in, they all seem like if those guys are in, Frank Shamrock ought to be in. He was essentially the first UFC light heavyweight champion. You know, it wasn't called the UFC light heavyweight title at the time, but he's the beginning of that lineage, of that division. And that fight that he had with Tito Ortiz in 1999 was sort of a marker for the sport and like a vision of what was to come for MMA. I remember watching it at the time, being a college student who super into jiu-jitsu, and therefore that's what got me into watching MMA. And then watching that fight and realizing, oh, something different is happening here in this one. Normally we're doing a guy comes in, he's a jiu-jitsu guy, he's a wrestler, he's a kickboxer, and he's learned a little bit of the other stuff, but he has one thing he wants to do. And this was kind of the first fight that you saw where Frank was doing MMA. He had a fighting style that was not just cobbled together pieces. It was made for MMA, for the rules, for the environment, all that stuff. And he went like, okay, this is becoming a sport. And he's also, though, he will admit, not always made himself easy to work with, and that the UFC was going to induct that fight into the Hall of Fame, at least. And then, you know, if that went well, they at least say they were going to then follow up by inducting him as a regular member of the UFC Hall of Fame. And he kind of shut that down. He made that difficult for them to do in ways that are detailed in the story. And then also, though, I think once you get to know Frank and you know a little bit about, you know, his upbringing, his past, you kind of realize there's something in him that is naturally rebellious, that kind of has a hard time letting you put your arm around him and love him. And when the UFC is kind of coming to him and saying, like, let's make nice, you be a good boy, show up when we tell you to, give the speech, don't be a jerk about it, there's some voice in his head that's kind of saying, like, don't let them control you that way. You know, you got to show that they can't control you by doing exactly what they ask you not to do. And that has made it difficult for the people. But when you talk to a lot of the people who know him, they're just like, you know, a lot of people in this sport who kind of came up with him. I talked to Boss Rutten, talked to Scott Coker, who worked with him on that big Strikeforce show. And they're all like, yeah, you know, look, the guy deserves a spot in the Hall of Fame. He was an important pioneer in this sport. And I think also the legacy stuff was a little on his mind because he feels like he's dealing with some brain stuff as a result of all the years of fighting. You know, he's not exactly sure what it is yet. He says he's been to see some neurologists, some specialists, but some scary stuff has happened with him recently. And he's in the position of sort of wondering where that's going to go from here. And I can understand why a guy at that time, especially, has it on his mind, wondering like how and if he'll be remembered by this sport that he gave a lot of his life to.
It sounds absolutely incredible. Yeah. I cannot wait to get stuck into that. And just a note on that, I always thought it was funny when he popped up for that Diaz fight as Mr. Establishment. As you say, my brother would always portray him as like, this guy is a punk, like this guy's a rebel. And then he was positioned as Mr. Establishment against the rebel for the Nick Diaz fight. And obviously much later on in his years, but that sounds like an absolutely tremendous article. Yeah. I cannot wait to read it. Make sure you get over to Uncrowned. Do you have anything coming up here, Chuck, or are you going to be dipping your head back into the gambling scandal next week?
Do I have a piece coming up, as I just said?
Yeah.
I mean, I've got pieces all the time, but nothing like I don't really have like a big feature in the hopper like this one. I can't wait to read this. Ben's one of the secretive guys. You never know what he's doing until it's there, you know? And if you tell him.
Well, you get this fancy artwork also.
Yeah, look at that. That's
nice. I didn't do the artwork, so
that is pretty cool.
I mean,
that's pretty cool.
When you look around, especially some of our bigger features and everything, and they've been able to do one for basically every one of the boxing history pieces I did, we got an amazing art team working for us here. Like you don't even have to give these guys a ton of direction. You're just like, I'm thinking about doing a story about these guys, this kind of thing. And they just come back with something that knocks your socks off. And they'll come back with it later that day or the next day. And I'm just blown away every single time. So I've never had this experience of having a great art team at our disposal. It really puts a little bit more of a polish on some of these stories when they come out.
I need to get one. GC keeps on slagging me that none of my articles have ever been given the art treatment, so I need to make that happen in 2026. He's right, though. He is completely right. Do we have any Super Chats, Mr. New York Rick?
Yeah, there it is. I love the pause. It creates a little bit of tension.
Remember
there
wasn't one the 1 week I remembered? It was like, there is no Super Chats. I was like, fuck! Andy McCarroll. Oh, Andy McCarroll of Extravision, the podcast in Ireland. I was on a recent episode speaking about Smashing Machine in honor of Pete's recent foray into movie reviews on the Extravision podcast. Thank you very much, Andy McCarroll. What are the rest of the guys' favorite sports movies?
What did you say when you were on there talking about Smashing Machine? Did you like it?
Yeah, I liked it. I think I picked as my favorite movies. I think I picked Raging Bull.
It's a good one.
I can't remember what else I picked. I think that was the only sports one I picked. I picked different movies, but that's probably my favorite one. What are your favorite sports movies?
Well, let's see. Wildcats, obviously, with Goldie Hawn. What else is there?
Rodney Dangerfield and Ladybugs. Like.
That was a good one, actually.
Caddyshack.
I mean, I like, I have a teenage boy, but like showing him movies like Hoosiers and Rudy, those kinds that are these uplifting movies are always, they're never old. Like you watch them, you're like, okay, this is still good. You know, always dug that. I don't know. What about you? Like in terms of combat movies, it's a lot harder.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I went back and watched Raging Bull for the first time in like 20 years when I wrote that LaMotta thing, and I was stunned at how good a movie it is, how closely it hews to his autobiography, but also just, I was like, this is not only a great boxing movie, it's a great biopic. It's one of Scorsese's best works, I think. I also really like Bull Durham, the baseball movie, one of my favorite all-time sports movies. And weirdly, a good boxing movie that at least tells you a lot about how the sport actually works and how combat sports in general actually work is The Great White Hype. That one with Samuel L. Jackson and Damon Wayans. And it's a comedy.
I haven't seen that since the day. Like it was when it was out.
It's a comedy, and it's very much a comedy of its time. It has a lot of where you're like, okay, I feel exactly when they made this just based on wardrobe. Jeff Goldblum's in it. But you watch that one, I remember thinking about it, especially during the Conor McGregor Floyd Mayweather buildup, where I'm like, it's The Great White Hype all over again.
Yeah.
we're doing almost exactly the same stuff. That one will really tell you something about how the sport goes, and it's actually pretty funny along the way.
It is really funny to go back and revisit Bad News Bears as well. There's a lot of anti-PC material in there.
It's about damn time we've got those wokies or whatever people say these days. Let's see what else we got there, Rick. Shout out, fellow crackheads. Evo, this is from, if Aspinall can't return before June, how surprised would you guys be if Dana straps him?
Strips him.
Okay. I thought he was going. I'm not going to say what I thought. And makes Jones Reaper with a heavyweight belt.
Pants are down. Strapping.
Don't strap him, for God's sake. Can't even see him. Look, if he did that, it would be a disgrace. You can't do that. Like, this guy has waited for so long to let the UFC fucking go about their business. I genuinely don't think they would do that. Look, they don't need to make Jones v. Pereira for a belt. And in fact, this whole situation with Gann has cleared the path for it to happen, which we were speaking about last week. So I don't think it's necessary. I think both things can happen. Tom can be the heavyweight champion and Jones can fight Pereira.
That's what we have the BMF title for, right? Is when we need to pull a shiny belt out of a closet somewhere, and we can grab that one. It doesn't mess with any of the divisions. We still have some hardware up for grabs. I agree. You don't need that for that fight, and you can just tell people, hey, the reason we're doing this one is because we're waiting for Tom and Cyril Gane to play out.
Yeah. Anything else, Derek? Jones' public groveling makes me think Jones Pereira isn't as close as it seems. Oh, that's a good point, actually, Ace Boogie, especially at the White House. Wouldn't be shocked if Dana offers a different card, take it or leave it, to spite John. And honestly, I saw him, like a new quote. I know we had his beg on from last week at Dirty Boxing. He did a good bit of begging with the schmo. He did it again. Like he's like, I just wish I could be with him, like to tell him how sorry I am. And I was like,
I saw that.
Puked in my mouth a bit. So I mean, maybe there is something to that.
Wish
maybe
I could be with him. Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, and but that's also would be a legitimate question, right? Because you would say to him like, hey, do you really want to come back and do this fight? Because we got an opening in Vancouver or something, you know, like, yeah. Do you only want to do it if you can fight on this card? And that would also tell us what he thinks his future is, would be like one and done, essentially. Like, so there, we're not going to put him into like a real title fight if he's just going to walk away afterwards. Is it only the place you want to fight at and not the opponent? Like, that is a fair question to ask of him.
Yeah. And obviously, like, if the belt isn't on the line, you know, if the belt, to remove him from the situation, like, you would make Pereira v. Aspinall if Jones was like, I'm coming back for one fucking fight. Like, what would be the point of that stage? You know what I mean?
Yep, I agree with that.
Anything else, Rick? Oh, we got a load. Evo, shout out Petey, Chuck, and Ben. Next time Ariel has Derek Moneyberg in studio, can't wait. I'd love to test his black belt at BJJ. I'm an SBG blue belt. Oh, under the great John Kavanagh. SBG, I trained there a bit myself back in the day before they wanted me dead. But yeah. I'm joking. It's not that serious. But Ben, like, how long has it been since you grappled? I was thinking about, could we just throw Ben and a leotard in to just fucking challenge Moneyberg the next time he's in studio?
Leotard? I got to put on a leotard for this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if they see, this is the thing. We've all heard about your arms and your big, strong grip. We need to give you some type of attire that makes Moneyberg go, hang on, this guy? I'm going to fuck him up. Leotard is the way.
Well, it's been a few years since I had to hang up my gi just because my neck finally got too bad from years and years of jiu-jitsu.
Trash neck. That's what
the pile of trash neck is real, and it'll still bother me every once in a while. But that's not to say I won't drink a couple few soda pops and wrestle someone on the living room floor. I still will do that. My friends can attest to that. We all went on a hot springs getaway. A whole bunch of us rented out this huge, awesome house here in Montana. The drinks flowed. Everybody stayed up super late. I got up the next morning, got into the hot springs, and I was like, ow, why is it sting like I have carpet burns all over? Oh, yeah.
Turns out you did.
That's it. I was in there passing people's guard and hitting them with the De La Riva sweeps at 3 o'clock in the morning on the carpet. That's why it feels that way. But sure, I'll take on Money Burke.
I have my doubts
about that black belt, you know, about its legitimacy and veracity. I would like to test it, and we'll see. Because if you can't beat me, then you don't deserve a black belt.
What a great glimpse into Montana life that was. It was good.
Sounds
I like
fucking
this.
Great. Ever injure your friends, though? I've done it a few times. Like, you know.
I was once demonstrating what a whizzer is on my friend Dan Brooks, and it threw his shoulder out of the joint. But, you know, in fairness, that had happened to his shoulder a whole bunch of times. I'm telling you, Google Sleeping Child Hot Springs if you want to see an awesome place that you can rent out for the weekend, and you can be like, oh, what drug dealer built this as a palace for himself? And I'll tell you what, there's an answer that fits exactly with what you're thinking.
Wow. Sold.
It sounds fantastic. Listen, lads, I love you very much. Fantastic day speaking about all of the scandals. Hopefully. Oh, sorry, excuse me. Evo, again, $5, just throwing out the fivers today. If we're crackheads, Chuck is the plug, Petey is the connect, and Ben is the dealer. Go Liverpool.
Woof. Yeah.
What's the difference between the plug and the dealer? I thought those were the same thing.
The plug is the guy that connects you to the dealer. Do you know what I mean?
Okay. All right.
It's fine.
PTO continues. On Air Jordan, on vacation still. Petey has a sick mansion in Blanche. I do. I'm not going to lie to you. We're building a moat around it now. So if you get near one of the crocs, we'll have your leg off. So stay away.
I hear your ballroom is coming along nicely.
Yeah, it is. We needed one. That's the thing with the ballroom. This year, I asked Santa for Randy Brown v. Bonfi. Well, lucky guy you are, Jean Plant.
I'd say aim higher next year. Let's ask him for something bigger.
Bonfi to take a dive in the second. You got it here first.
Well, fucking hell. I don't know if that's the end of this, but we do love yous very much, and I love the boys very much. Thank you to New York Rick. I hope On Air Jordan's having a wonderful vacation. Thank you to Oscar Losef. Thank you to Ben Folks. Thank you to Chuck Mendenhall. We will see you next week on The Crack. Big kisses.